going on? This is Toki and Noah, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. We have the great Tim Gallagher on, basketball historian, and Grant Goodstein. Gentlemen, it's so great to talk to you. And what a game last night. Oh my gosh. Game one of the finals. Obviously going to be remembered for the incredible idiocy displayed by J.R. Smith. But there were a lot of other things that happened in that game. Unfortunately, probably overshadowing the greatness of LeBron James. 51 points. Let's start out with you, Tim. I'll go over to you really quick. Your initial thoughts, why don't we get your initial thoughts on the game overall and then get specifically into that last play where J.R. Smith basically cost or potentially cost his team a game.
Right. Well, and there were sure a lot of subplots to the game, and it's the matchup I think most fans really wanted to see, even though it's kind of a repetitive scene we've been experiencing over the last 4 years, but it's as a basketball fan, these are the most elite and talented players. I guess a few things on JR. As I thought about it, we're presuming these guys are thinking time and score and aware of all the details, and I kind of had to laugh to myself thinking all these big shots JR Smith made through the years during the playoffs. He's probably oblivious to the time and score, so he's just hoisting it up and making big shots. If he thought too much about it, it might affect his performance. So there's no excuse for not knowing time and score in that kind of situation and at that level. I totally don't buy that he knew it was tied, because once he got the rebound, you see guys get rebounds and cradle it and call timeout all the time, right?
Absolutely.
Or put it back up. So. Unfortunately, it did overshadow LeBron's amazing performance. I was surprised LeBron, on a couple possessions earlier, passed the ball to George Hill. I thought, he had Curry guarding him, the ball in his hands, just take it to the rack or make something happen on his own. But he, that was kind of a thread-the-needle pass to Hill, even though he got open for a second and Thompson grabbed him. So that was the other thing that sort of surprised me, that LeBron didn't just take matters into his own hands. So those are a couple of my observations. I hope the series can live up to what a great game one it was, and we see some more good basketball over the rest of the series.
Yeah, Grant, I'd like to get your thoughts on the same questions.
Yeah, I think something maybe people are overlooking even to another level with J.R. Smith in terms of boneheaded play. The boneheaded play he made at the end of the first half where he went for the gamble steal and left step wide open for that 30-foot three that he loves to hit at the buzzer, seemingly time after time. Those 3 points, as we saw, really came down to make a difference at the end of the game. And that's one, obviously, just one of the all-time NBA Finals performances from LeBron. I mean, when he has his jump shot going, there's absolutely no chance you can guard him. And he played as well as he could possibly play, and my heart breaks a little bit for him that his teammates couldn't quite come through, but just a great game, and I think that the series should be resolved in 5 or 6 games here, but I love the fight that the Cavs showed, even though they're quite a bit undermanned. I feel like we're going to get some great games in this series.
Yeah.
One other quick comment I had, sure. too, is being a basketball historian, I have to put a little plug in for the graphic. Obviously, LeBron crept into that very elite list of players that have scored 50 or more in a finals game. And just seeing that list, Baylor 61, Jordan 55, Rick Barry 55, West 53. It's kind of amazing to me that through all these years, whenever you see those lists that kind of pop up, where Rick Barry and Jerry West seem to always be on those lists, and Jordan as well. So even as the decades go by and the games evolve, and especially, I guess, Baylor and Barry and West, where there weren't as many opportunities, there weren't as many games played, weren't as many teams, the playoffs didn't go as long. So just that these guys – accomplishments have held up over all this time is pretty impressive to me.
Yeah, I really felt for LeBron last night. It was one of the best performances I've ever seen. I was in absolute amazement of how well he played. It really brought to mind Jordan in 1986 dragging a team with, you know, basically the second best player on that team was a young Charles Oakley and a bum like Dave Corzine and a bum like Orlando Woolridge and scaring the heck out of the 86 Celtics. I really had visions of that watching that game last night. I thought he was so far and above everyone else on his team that it was almost an embarrassment. And for his teammates to let him down like that in the final minutes, I mean, you know, just Hill needs to make the free throw, and him missing it and Smith, you know, just screwing up. I really felt for him. I also felt the officiating was horrific. Clearly, Golden State benefited from some very key calls. I'd like to touch on one of those right now, the charge / block call that was reversed. I thought it was an appalling reversal. I understand it's according to the rules. I just didn't think there was enough evidence to say, hey, that should be changed from a charge to a block. You can be moving. It's unbelievable that there's suddenly this general idea that you have to be completely still in order to get that call. No, you can be moving a little bit, and I thought he had position, both feet planted. I don't understand why you reversed that call. Why don't we start with you, Tim, on that one?
Well, I thought it was a block. However, because the officials, you know, made the call as it was initially, and the fact that it was LeBron, right, a guy of his stature and accomplishments, and we know it's not an objective situation, and certain players get certain calls to their benefit, and because it was LeBron as well into the mix, I was stunned that they reversed the call as well, and I can't really remember a situation where they've reversed it in that fashion ever. I know Tyronn Lue said in the history of the game, I'm sure there's probably been some other odd situations where a call's been reversed, but on that stage and of a player of LeBron's stature, right? So kind of I give LeBron the benefit of the doubt, right? If he took a charge at that point of the game against Durant and it's LeBron. Now, if it was, you know, Jordan Clarkson making that play, obviously you don't give Jordan Clarkson any benefit of the doubt or some lesser player. But because it was LeBron, I agree. I thought it would be very surprising and shocking. And also the Tristan Thompson quick rejection in the last 2 seconds, which I didn't think that was a dirty play at all. And it was a basketball play. And for him to be ejected without even review was surprising to me as well.
Grant?
Yeah, I have a couple different thoughts here. One is just kind of the strange idea that this is the only situation in the game where a foul can be reviewable. Kind of bizarre that it can only happen the last 2 minutes when it comes to the guy in the restricted area or not, then you can holistically review that. I feel like replays bogged down the game quite a bit in the last 2 minutes. I would go to a challenge system a little bit more like the NFL, where a coach has a certain number of challenges for the game, and that's going to be that without the automatic review of everything in the last 2 minutes. If it's so egregious, the coach can use his challenge to overturn it. But that's my opinion there on replay. As far as the play itself, I did think it was a block. I agree with both Fred and Tim here. Fred, and that you say, I don't think your feet have to be set to take a charge. I think it's just all about being in legal guarding position. And my main objection to a lot of the charge block calls that we see today, especially in college, just the refs love to call a charge. And a charge becomes a play in and of itself, not a legitimate basketball play. I hate that a guy tries to get his feet over and just fall down. And basically that's the defensive. If a guy's got a strong chest, his hands are up, and he legitimately gets bowled over, that's what a charge is. It's an offensive player misusing and having a lack of control of their body. When it comes to running to a spot and falling down, I mean, there's no worse play in basketball to me.
Yeah, I felt, you know, like the NFL, there has to be overwhelming evidence for a call to be reversed. And you know, it probably was leaning more towards a block. The block charge call is the hardest call to make, I think, in professional sports. It's a very difficult, very subjective call. And I just felt there was not enough evidence, nearly enough evidence to say, yeah, that's clearly a block. You got to reverse the call. It was just horrific officiating. It's not just that. It's I think Durant gets more the benefit of more calls than even LeBron. I'm appalled at some of the calls he just gets for, you know, basically just running into guys or just flopping and throwing his hands up. And there were several plays with Durant. One specifically they called him LeBron, I thought was a clean strip. I can't stand. I find him the most irritating player in the NBA is Draymond Green. I can't stand his reaction to every call. He clearly followed LeBron, and he acted in the one call where he got a technical, which was well-deserved. I couldn't believe his reaction. You know, just screaming at the officials, berating the officials. I can't stand the guy. I think he's, you know, he was 3 of 24 from, or 3 of 25 from 3. And the minute I tweeted that out, he ends up hitting, you know, two huge threes in a row. So I should probably stop, bad mouthing him. But, you know, that said, they're not even guarding Draymond Green. It's so hilarious watching this game. And you see a guy like Curry just attract so much attention and have so much gravity. And then a player like Draymond Green, who's allegedly one of the best in the league, they're not even paying attention to him practically, you know, when he's standing out there. And I just find it kind of fascinating to me. The Warriors are really, they're susceptible right now because I don't think Durant's playing with a ton of confidence. And when they just kind of go to that ISO game with him, I think they're susceptible to be beat. It's just the Cleveland doesn't have enough to do it. What do you say, Grant?
Yeah, Draymond's regression has been absolutely shocking to me.
Yeah.
I thought as of 2 years ago, he was one of the 10 best players in the league. He was a total difference maker, of course, on the defensive end, but when it's a guy like that who makes great passes and is also a threat to make like 36-37% of your threes, he was absolutely essential to that team. And it's pretty disturbing. I'm not sure what happened. It looks like he also might not be in. He looks really tired by the end of games, which is totally understandable, but he doesn't seem to be in his peak condition as he may have been a year or two ago. Could have something to do with being the defending champions and not having that same hunger in the offseason. But that, to me, is the biggest thing that makes the Warriors susceptible this season and going forward is Draymond's regression in terms of his offensive game.
Yeah, what do you think, Tim?
I agree. It's kind of shocking to me the way the Warriors have played over the last few seasons. When you see you see Draymond open at the three-point line and he elects not to shoot. You know, it's just, it's got to be really disruptive to their offense, right? Because it's a shot that he's been expected to take and mostly make over the last few years. And just his overall demeanor, you know, just in that last play after he got in the scuffle with Tristan Thompson, I really think Draymond was kind of taunting him, right? With that
yes.
kind of clap and,
yeah,
look,
no doubt.
And look, right? So he brings a lot of that stuff on. And I just don't totally buy it or give him the pass. Oh, he's just a competitor, and he goes over the line. And I'm really
he's
kind of surprised Kerr doesn't rein him in a little more.
I don't think he can. I mean, Kerr and him have had several notable blow-ups to the point that even this year, I think Green had an interview where he said he thought he was going to be traded. I think it was in 2016 to a major blow-up that they had. And the guy's just a jerk. He's just a total jerk, and I don't like the way he plays the game. As far as, like, you know, I think he does a lot of taunting. I think he does a lot of bordering on, there's no doubt about it. I mean, he punched LeBron in the balls before. I mean, we've seen him do things that I think border on dirty. He's a very good player. I'm not going to deny that. But what I disagree vociferously with anyone is that if you dropped him on another team and you said he's going to be your best player, that team's a lottery team. I don't think he's anywhere near in the stratosphere that Curry, Thompson, or Durant are. He's just, and I think he should thank God every day that he was drafted by a team with two of the best shooters in NBA history, because he gets all that space and he's allowed to do so much on the offensive end that no other great player would have. I mean, they don't even bother to guard his first threes that he took in that game. There wasn't a player within 6 feet of him, and he bricked them all. And then, you know, to his credit, he made the last two. And I understand he's great defensively. But I agree with you, Grant, when you said that his drop-off is what's made this team susceptible. Also, Durant. I think Durant, you know, I thought Durant really picked up his defense several years ago. His last year in Oklahoma City, I was really impressed with how well he played defensively. And he had a great year last year to win that title. I felt he's been doing far too much ISO in these playoffs. And last night he was 8 of 22, 36%. That's horrific. 1 of 7 from 3. He did not play well. And he's gifted 10 free throws, and he shot made 9 of them to his credit again. And he had 9 rebounds and 6 assists. But I did not think he played well. And I think that's the way to beat that team is to force them in ISOs with him and hope that he settles for those long twos.
Yeah, I agree. I think, obviously, we saw in Game 7, Kevin Durant still has that really, really high level that's basically as Tiki, when he's on his game, he can play as well as anyone in the league. But we definitely haven't seen as much consistency this year. I do think that he'll show up the rest of the finals, and I trust that he will be there in the moments that it counts most.
Yeah, and I will say I want to also touch on Cleveland really quick. You know, Kobe Altman took a big victory lap after that trade with the Lakers. That trade was an abomination. If you look at the guys in that team that came here, Jordan Clarkson yesterday, 2-9, he was awful. He was terrible in that game. He gunned up 9 shots in 17 minutes and absolutely sucked, and he was wide open in most of those shots. Larry Nance Jr., I thought, did provide some good moments. But again, 1 for 4 from the free throw line, inexcusable. You know, Kevin Love, I thought, was the only guy on Cleveland outside of, you know, Larry Nance Jr. did have a couple of nice moments. Korver hit a big shot. But I the rest of that team and the rest of those big pieces that they got in the trade were, for the most part, just an embarrassment. And it was only the greatness of LeBron, you know, 51 points in 47 minutes that even put him to that point, 10-11 from the free throw line. What say you, Tim?
Well, I agree. And I thought after those players started to integrate with the Cavs system late in the season, I expected a little more. Even Rodney Hood looked pretty good in some regular season games, and he doesn't even get off the bench now. George Hill did okay at moments. Obviously, a veteran that's had the experience that he's had, you got to knock down those free throws. You know, easier said than done when so much is on the line. But, yeah, that trade isn't looking quite as productive right now. And
yeah.
Clarkson did have a lot of looks, and I think he had a few turnovers too. I know I remember him getting the ball stripped, and just you gotta contribute somehow if your shot's not falling. And if Cleveland has any chance, they need to get more out of those guys. I just can't imagine LeBron carrying this load game after game. Although I've been saying that for years and throughout this playoffs, and here we are.
Yeah. Grant, any thoughts on the surrounding cast? Like, one final point I'll make on this. If I'm LeBron, there's no way I'm sticking around for this nonsense. And Kobe Altman could go pound sand. And if anybody in Cleveland is that stupid to blame him for leaving, he's 33, he's not going to live forever. He's chasing one guy, and he needs to win titles. And you can't win titles with this kind of incompetence and this kind of just horrible play from your teammates. I thought Love played pretty well, but outside of him, no one else deserves to even be mentioned. It was just such an abomination for last night. I don't know if you feel the same way.
Yeah, they're really. This is a team that's one piece away from really being able to compete at the highest level in the series. I still don't feel like they're even close in terms of talent to Golden State, and they need a game like LeBron had last night to even sniff a chance at winning in Oakland. Altman couldn't execute on that. They couldn't bring in anyone that's really been able to contribute. I mean, Jordan Clarkson played one of the worst playoff games I've ever seen, and he got 17 minutes last night. It's not like they brought him in for a three-minute segment on the bench. Off the bench, he plays horrible, and they keep him on the bench. That's not even an option. They have to play him serious minutes every night. So definitely a real disappointment in terms of the surrounding talent they've been able to put around LeBron.
And one final note, Kyle Korver was a plus 12 in 16 minutes. I know he's awful defensively. You have to have him on the court. You have to have him because he's one of the few guys that makes the court look like a 4-4 game for LeBron because nobody's going to leave him. And there's a reason that he was a plus 12 and J.R. Smith was a minus 22. You know, so, I mean, that's another thing that's got to change. He's, you know, Lou's fallen in that same nonsense that Tibb did, just looking on one side of the ball. You got to realize that these benefits that Korver provides, even when he doesn't touch the ball, and he's not playing enough. So, and that was my last comment on that. Tim, anything else before we wrap this baby up and move on to the draft?
No,
No, I think we're good. I'm eager to hear Grant's perspectives of especially the Villanova players, seeing them play in person at both games at the Final Four, as well as any other draft prospects. So we'd love to hear Grant on that.
Yeah, so Grant, let's get into that right now, because the Bulls that stand at number 7, it's pretty interesting right now where we see some guys that are supposedly falling, like Michael Porter Jr., guys I'm high on, like Wendell Carter Jr., potentially moving up. And then obviously the Bridges, both Bridges, Nova Bridges and Michigan State Bridges, Miles, you know, kind of moving up, I would say. I'd say Miles is moving up and it seems Mikal's moving down. Love to get your opinion on some of these players. Let's start out with Mo Bamba, who's kind of seems like I'm alone on an island who believes this guy's going to be a major bust. Other people just absolutely love him, and he's clearly got some physical skills or physical talent in that 8-foot wingspan. But I have major concerns that guy's going to be the next Willie Cauley-Stein. What say you about Mo Bamba? Let's get your analysis of him first before we move on to some of these other players.
Yeah, I like Mo Bamba quite a bit. I don't know if I like him enough to draft him in the top 5, but I think in terms of his length and his athleticism and his ability to block shots and be a difference maker defensively, I think that's worth a lot in this league. And just these rim protectors are so essential. It doesn't necessarily have to come from a 7-footer, but he is one of these guys who I think is going to be an impact difference maker on the defensive end. And I think that's where his value really comes. He's shown some signs of having a little bit of touch around the basket and even extending out to mid-range. And I don't even know that he has to be a fantastic offensive player in order to be a solid rotation guy and starter because of what he does on the defensive end. Overall, I like him. I actually think if for whatever reason he did fall to 7 to the Bulls, he'd be an acceptable choice there, and I think would be pretty good value at that 7 spot. But yeah, I think that he'll have a solid career in the NBA.
Do you like him more than Michael Porter Jr. at 7?
I do not. I like Michael Porter Jr. more. I think it's pretty clearly a wing dominated league, and you've got to have an elite scoring wing to be able to contend in the playoffs. So I think if you're looking at building a championship team, Michael Porter Jr. is the guy who could be one of those centerpiece guys, the first, second, or third best guy on a really competitive playoff team. So I would prefer to go Porter. I think he's a bit undervalued given that he didn't have a chance to play much last season.
What about, let's get into the Bridges. Miles and Mikal, who do you like better? And would you prefer, in order, Bridges, both Bridges, Michael Porter Jr. you have, out of those three, which one do you like the best?
Sure. So I think when you're comparing Michael Bridges to Miles Bridges, I think Miles Bridges has the higher floor, where Michael Bridges has the higher ceiling. I think Miles Bridges is going to be a really solid guy. He struggled at Michigan State to be the lead alpha dog. He's not that kind of guy, and I think that's what actually makes him a really good value in this draft, is he's not going to be asked to carry the weight for an NBA team like he did at Michigan State. He's a perfect guy as your second or third best guy on the team. He can sit in the corner, make threes, touch the rim. He's actually a great garbage guy cleaning up around the rim as well. I think he's going to be really solid, but might not have that superstar potential, which I think Michael Bridges actually does. He's super, super athletic, total difference maker. He's going to be an excellent defender and has a lot of potential. On offense, has shown a really good three-point shooting stroke. I'd say in order, I'd probably go Michael Bridges number 1, Michael Porter Jr. number 2, and Miles Bridges number 3.
Okay, how about Wendell Carter Jr.?
Carter Jr. is solid. Another guy that I think, again, like, this is a really strong draft, and when you have number 7 pick like the Bulls, I think there's a really solid chance you're going to end up with a really good player. I don't know that I like him as much as Bamba or any of those three guys. Bill Simmons has a really good way that he thinks about the draft that I've been thinking about quite a bit as I've been watching the playoffs. He says, with the proximity of the draft to the NBA Finals and conference finals, it's really easy to look at it this way. You look at a guy and say, would he be able to make an impact or play on the floor I think for Carter, not quite as much as some of the others. I don't see him being as much of an impact guy given where the league is and where it's going. He's pretty, like, big, bulky, 6'10" dude. I don't know how much opportunity those guys have unless they could be a really, really impact player defensively. And I just don't think he has that same feeling on the defensive end as Bamba.
And then I know you got a hard stop, so do you have time for one more?
Yeah, I got time for one more.
Luka Doncic. Like to get your take on him, who seems to be on another flashpoint. Some people love him. Some people think he's going to bust. What's your take on Luka?
Yeah, I'd probably take him number one in this draft if I had the first pick, if I were the Phoenix Suns. He's still, 18 or 19 years old, and is playing at a really high level. I think some people tend to, NBA guys don't, but maybe some fans tend to underestimate what the level of competition is at the top of the EuroLeague he's playing on. The best Spanish team in Real Madrid. I think he's a really solid player. He's a very, very good playmaker. And I think it's a little short-sighted to see a guy with that size and playmaking ability slip out of the top two or three. I think the teams will come to regret that.
All right. Grant, thank you so much for jumping on the Bullseye. Tim, you got a few more minutes to hold on?
I do.
Great. Grant, thanks again, my man. Appreciate you jumping on. Tim, want to get your take a little bit now. If Michael Porter Jr., I want to go back to him a little bit because there seems to be some concerns about this back injury. And I know you were the first guy I spoke with a long time ago who felt that he was, you know, probably the consensus number one if he didn't get hurt, before he got hurt. Are you still as high on him, or has there been anything in the interim that's kind of soured you a bit on him?
Well, there's certainly concerns about his medical situation. I know we had Dr. Bob on, and he kind of relieved some of my concerns. But I'm assuming the Bulls, and I've heard you talk on some of the other podcasts with other Bulls analysts, to put him through the medicals and, you know, make sure he checks out from that standpoint. I assume I don't believe the Bulls have had him in yet, or if they did, I didn't see the outcome, but I think as long as the medical's clear, I saw in the ESPN mock drafts, I think it was Mike Schmitz had him at 15, which was very alarming, which led me to believe, is there some information on his health that that's the only way I could see him in anybody's mock draft being out of the top 8 or 10, even in worst case. So, obviously, I can't say there's no concern about his health because he had the back injury and missed most of his freshman season, played very sparingly. But I think Grant kind of hit the nail on the head where, the way the league is now, I see Porter as kind of a hybrid of a Jason Tatum, Kevin Durant kind of a talent, right? And at 6'11", and the ability to play small forward or multiple positions, I just like his skill set and the kind of players that are thriving in the league right now. I think he fits that mold if healthy. Obviously, the big asterisk is if healthy. And Tom,
yeah, before we wrap up,
I don't have any inside information.
Yeah, before we wrap up, I did want to talk about a few of the Villanova guys that are coming out, two of whom I absolutely love. I also love, obviously, Mikal Bridges. Not as high on Jalen Brunson, but Dante DiVincenzo, who just was absolutely fantastic in the finals game, I think has a tremendous upside. I think he's in a league that's where shooting is at a premium. He sure as heck brings it. And Omari Spellman, who I fell in love with during the year, 6'8", kind of like a power forward type that can shoot the three at 43%. He can also block shots and play great defense. I love both of those players with the 22nd pick. Why don't you go a little bit in depth about each one and how you feel about each one?
For sure. Well, I agree with you on Spellman, and I really like the way he played this year. And really, for both of those players, a couple of things that mean a lot to me in terms of just looking at a player's background. And both of them redshirted a year at Villanova, so they've got that additional level of maturity and
and kind of got to maybe see the game from a different angle and maybe gain some appreciation of both, you know, on and off the floor about, you know, what it takes to succeed, and certainly just the Villanova way, which, you know, the success they've had in winning a couple championships in recent years, you know, means a lot. And I know the Bulls have, over the years, drafted a lot of players from winning programs, and, you know, and that's helped foster the culture and obviously the run with Noah and, you know, Noah and Rose and you know, Ben Gordon and players like that, you know, played in Final Fours, won Final Fours in some cases. So anyway, I like both of their backgrounds, and obviously the, you know, Mikal Bridges and Brunson fit in that same category. So yes, DiVincenzo, I really like. I like his energy. I watched a little of him in the combine, and I love the fact that he was there, that he tested so highly in some of the athletic measurements. I like that he was playing and wanted to play. Like, bring it on, let's play. This is what I do. You know, I'm a little more skeptical of guys that, you know, are sitting out, or, you know, maybe they do have a guarantee or some other reason why they're not playing, or their agents keeping them out of it. But the fact that he was there and played and did well, I just like that mindset, right? Eventually, you got to get on the court and show you can do it. and he seems to not have any reservations about doing that. With Spellman, I'm probably making a big leap here, but I really see him as an Al Horford-type player. He's got that kind of size, but the ability to stretch the floor as well, and just being from a winning culture, I really like him. I can't imagine he'd still be on the board at 22, although I've seen some of the mock drafts. He's kind of all over the place, but very high on Spellman. If DiVincenzo was there at 22 for the Bulls, it'd be hard to pass him up as well. So, you know, love them all.
Sounds great.
Brunson, I've got a little concerns. I mean, maybe you could get him in the second round, a backup point guard. Is he a poor man's Michael Conley, something like that? Not sure what his ceiling is, but certainly a steady, reliable backup, if nothing else. A little concerned about him being undersized.
Yeah, I got him as his ceiling to me in the NBA is as a backup point guard. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just something I don't want to take a first-round pick on. You know, so if he's available at 22, I'm looking for somebody with a little bit more upside. And so that's why I'd pass. But a guy like Spellman, I would absolutely love at 22. I'm kind of shocked that there hasn't been more noise around him with his size and his shooting ability and his blocking shots, his ability to protect the rim. He's exactly like you. As what Grant said, I could absolutely see him playing in this series on Green. You know, I think he's got a lot of Draymond Green characteristics, probably a better shot, probably not as good defensively, but I love that kid. So, hey, before we wrap it up, Tim, I can't thank you enough for joining the Bullseye. Let's get a little bit your prediction for the remainder of the series. I mean, do you think it's going to be a sweep now, or do you think that LeBron has shown that there's enough in the tank that they could possibly extend this out?
Well, my pre-series prediction was Warriors in five. I was, frankly, a little surprised that Cleveland was so competitive on the road in game one. And, you know, LeBron is certainly at such an elite level that it's shown that with him, anything's possible. So, but Cleveland, I think they're, no matter how you look at it in terms of, you know, getting some unfortunate calls made against them with the officiating, and I'm assuming that there's not going to be any suspension of Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love. I don't think what they did was worthy of that. You know, how nitpicky where they were showing the spotlight on Kevin Love being off the bench in those last 2 seconds of the game. So I'm assuming that Thompson and Love are on the floor and things, are business as usual despite some of the late game craziness there. But I can't imagine Cleveland winning more than one or two games. So I'm going to say Warriors in five. How about you?
Yeah, I think I had the Warriors in five, too, I believe, before the series. I think there's nothing that – I think that probably Cleveland will get a game in Cleveland. I'm not sure if it'll be game three or game four, but they play much better there, and you could see some, you know, Korver going crazy or something like that and stealing a game, but you know, unless LeBron just continues to play like he did last night, It could go six. I mean, he was so good. I was just blown away. I just don't see him continuing, especially from long distance like he was yesterday. He was hitting threes like he was incredible. You know, so
were you surprised that he gave up the ball to George Hill late in the game?
I agree with you, but you know,
Curry had the ball in his hands. Curry, top of the key. You've seen other possessions where he took Curry to the rim and scored.
And just dominated him physically. I agree.
When I say relatively easily.
I agree.
He takes contacts as well as anybody I've ever seen play the game. And
I agree with you, with the exception that he was wide open and it was a corner three, and correct me if I'm wrong. I think they were down two at that point. Were they down two? I think they were down two, so they could have given them a lead by one if you would have made it. But
No, they were down. I'm talking the play where George Hill did the little back cut and Thompson fouled.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're talking about – I was talking about the missed – I know there was a missed three in the corner in the last 2 minutes where I felt like LeBron did the right play. You're talking about the last play of the game where that Hill got to the line. No, I actually didn't have a problem with that. I actually thought that was a great pass, and he had, you know, clearly beaten Thompson. And I thought Hill kind of baited the call a little bit, though. I thought he kind of overacted a little bit. I didn't think it was as serious of a pull. It looked like that to me, and the vet got the really kind of overemphasized the hook. But I thought it was a great pass,
right.
A great cut, and you know, it's just a shame for LeBron. And I really found myself cheering for him last night because of how well he played. He was just absolutely fantastic. I do want to say one thing, though. I understand guys stretch the rules in the NBA. You can't let a guy cross the line before the ball hits the rim on a free throw. And he was 9 of 10 yesterday. And he's been doing it in playoffs. In one game they called it. I seen it. But this is something that has to be addressed with him. You can't allow that. I mean, it's not a problem for anybody in the NBA. I don't. The way he shoots free throws is so strange and unique, where he shoots it and then his foot enters the lane before the ball hits the rim. That you can't allow that. I just don't understand why they let that go. Do you find it as maddening as I do?
Well, I don't. I haven't really noticed that, to be honest.
Oh my gosh,
it's an issue. So
yeah, look how he shoots free throws. He does it every
player,
time.
You know, some of the great players obviously get a little longer leash in terms of either being able to carry the ball or you know, maybe an extra, you know, half step or step here and there. I'm okay with that. I think, I don't know, okay with it in the sense that I'm used to it, and not that I think it's good or justified.
Yeah, I would just counter. Watch for it next time, Tim, because I would counter that. I've never seen a player shoot free throws like that. Most guys, when they shoot free throws, their feet are stationary, and it's a common play in basketball, a free throw shot. And you can't bend the rules on a free throw.
Right.
It's like insanity to me. And he clearly is entering the lane, and his foot is making contact with the paint before the ball hits the rim, a second or two before. And sometimes it's egregious,
right.
And they did call it before, but I don't know. It's something that I would definitely need to talk to him about in the offseason because it's bizarre to me. I just don't see guys shooting free throws like that. And if Shaq was able to do that, where he was able to basically lean towards the rim, and then a second or two before the ball, you know, hit the rim, he was able to touch the paint. You're creating a much easier shot by getting that much closer to the rim. So, I don't know. We'll agree to disagree on that one. But on that note, man, thanks again for jumping the Chicago Bullseye. You always bring the goods, as usual, and it's always great to talk with you. Looking forward to touching base with you next week and to find out where we're at as we get a little bit closer to the end of the finals and closer to the draft. All the best to you, my brother.
Right. All right. You too, Fred. Always a pleasure, and enjoy the rest of the series, and we'll talk soon. And, yeah, very exciting times with the finals and all the excitement around that, as well as what's going to happen with the draft. It's great discussion.
All right, my man. Have a good one. Talk to you soon.